Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining me today is Edwin Truman. Edwin Truman has been a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics since 2001. He served as Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury for International Affairs from December 1998 to January 2001 and as Counselor to the Secretary from March to May 2009. He directed the Division of International Finance of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System from 1977 to 1998. Truman has been a member of several international working groups and has taught at Yale, 1967 to 74, Amherst, 2006, 2008, and 2010, and Williams College, 2008, 2010, 2012, 2014. He's the author, co-author, or editor of Reforming the IMF for the 21st Century, 2006, A Strategy for IMF Reform, 2006, Chasing Dirty Money, The Fight Against Money Laundering, 2004, Inflation Targeting in the World Economy, 2003, and Sovereign Wealth Funds, Threat or Salvation, 2010. He has a BA, an honorary LLD from Amherst College, and a PhD from Yale University in Economics. Welcome, Ted Truman.
My pleasure.
I'm glad you're here. Let's start at the beginning. Where were you born?
Well, I was born right here in Albany, New York, 72 years ago, and I was only here for a couple of weeks, which is how long women were kept in hospitals at that point, because my father was at that point teaching at Bennington.
Ah. Now, I don't want to dote on your father too much, but he was an amazing man, obviously, one of the most important academics in the United States. Tell us a little about him.
Well, David Truman, my father, was a political scientist who went to Amherst as well, got a PhD from Chicago, moved around a number of universities, colleges and universities, served in Washington during World War II, as many people in his generation did, ultimately ended up at Columbia University during the disorders of late 1960s. He had been there for 19 years.
And he was presumed, he was number two, he was presumed that he was going to be the next president.
He was the number two at the university, which had many internal problems and many external problems, because that was a very difficult time of in the world, in the country. Vietnam, Martin Luther King, all kinds of things like that. And fortunately, he was given an offer to become president of Mount Holyoke College, which he did for 9 years.
So he landed on his feet.
He landed on his feet. And he was a very, as you said, a very influential political scientist, but social scientist, and had a lot of influence as an academic and as an academic administrator.
One of the things I loved about him, and I was privileged to meet him just once, was the fact that he wrote the book about American government.
He wrote a book in 1950 called The Governmental Process. That book still generates revenues.
It's amazing.
Not a lot, but you know, a few hundred dollars a year.
Yeah.
One way or the other, and was even about 10 years ago translated into Chinese.
There was a story, perhaps not quite accurate, that once when asked why he never wrote a second major book, he said, because I only had one book in me.
That was true. He did write some more books, but they weren't major. I mean, he did a very interesting, subsequently did a very interesting study of something probably would interest you, of the Congress, voting behavior in the Congress, and yeah. It was one of the first studies that used computers to sure. match up voting behavior of different blocks and so forth and so on. In the mid-1960s, my mother actually programmed the computer. She didn't program the computer. She wired the board. She went to school, learned how to wire computer boards. They had these punch cards as they matched
Yeah,
up.
Those were the days we did Fortran and things like that.
It was pre-Fortran. It was pre-Fortran. And it was very interesting. And it was methodologically on the cutting edge, even though it doesn't generate revenues, at least not that I've seen.
As a social scientist, was he, because I'm going to ask you the same question as we go, was as a social scientist, did he dabble in politics? In other words, if you took a look at Vietnam, if you took a look at the other things that were going on in the world, would you have identified him with a group? There was guys like Max Kampelman and his Gene Kirkpatrick on one side and, you know, the lefties, Mark Rudd and the others, you know, on the other side. So,
Gene Kirkpatrick was one of his students at Columbia.
Right.
I think he advised from time to time. I know in 1952, a long time ago, he wrote and submitted a couple of speeches to Adlai Stevenson. I don't think they were used, but you know, those days, some professor could write a speech and send it into the campaign, and they might or may not use it. Now it would all be done much more, I don't know, scientifically. So he wasn't very active. And I think by the time he became an academic administrator, he felt that it was probably not appropriate to do so.
I remember I wrote him a letter when there was a bunch of academics who had written about the Vietnam War, and I wrote him a letter and said, well, why didn't you sign this letter? And he basically said, I didn't think it was really in my place to use my position as then president of Mount Holyoke to speak out on these kinds of issues in that kind of way. It was a period in which some college presidents were getting arrested for chaining themselves to the White House fence or Westover Air Force Base, and others were a little more neutral.
And where were you?
So in the 60s, I was at Yale. I mean, I graduated from Amherst in 1963, and then I went to Yale, and then I stayed on and was on the faculty until the early 1970s. And so when all this hubbub was happening in college campuses around the country, it was there at Yale. Yale was a little late coming to it. It didn't blow up until 1970. So it was a little late. But we had our own excitement in 1970. Yeah. And it was also a formative experience.
Yeah, but what would you say if you wrote him a letter and said, how come you didn't sign that? Was that a giveaway that was your position? He should have signed it?
Yeah, I thought he should have signed it. I mean, it was not, as I remember, it was not a sort of flamethrower letter. It was a sort of, this is a serious problem and we have to figure out a way to solve this problem type of letter rather than this is all wrong.
You know, famous fathers and famous mothers raise issues. Here you are, as anybody who heard your biography that I read in the beginning would know, you're a very distinguished man who's done a great deal in your life so far. So, you know, I see the children of very famous people, and I say to myself, well, what happens to some of them? The Roosevelt kids, for example, didn't do particularly well in their lives. You've done very well. What do you think makes the difference?
Well, one difference was that I decided that I wanted to be an academic, but I decided I didn't want to be a political scientist, partly because there was already a Truman political scientist. So my father actually encouraged me to go into economics, so that I was off in a different direction in my early part of my career. Certainly as an academic, many people would say, well, you're David Truman's son. It was an advantage that I sort of took this fork in the road and went on leave to the Federal Reserve Board in 1972, because in that environment, although there were some people in Washington who knew my father, not many, and so there was very little of this sort of, oh, well, you're David Truman's son. So I was able to make my own way, not as I originally intended, as an academic, but in government, and was fortunate to as I say, reach my level of incompetence at a relatively young age at the Federal Reserve and work with some very interesting and fascinating men, a few women, and had the opportunity to sit at the second row to watch 40-plus years of international economic and financial issues.
So I'm very interested in this. I wanted to sort of double back for one second. In some university settings around the world, it's not political science, it's political economy. And when you said that you became an economist as opposed to a political scientist, you still had to deal with many of the same policy issues, right?
Yes, and I think the fact that I actually didn't take much political science directly at Amherst, I took a lot of political theory courses from a famous professor by the name of George Kateb. But I didn't major in political science, in part because the department was largely dysfunctional, at least in the view of my father at the time. And the economics department was very strong. But I was interested in public policy, and public policy involves politics. And one of the strengths and interesting aspects of working at a place like the Federal Reserve is, on the one hand, it's apolitical. B, because of the way it's structured, many of the people, the senior people who are on the board and the chairman are appointed by one president, and then you get another president. And it is a sufficiently controversial, sometimes, institution that in order to make its way, it actually has to deal with both sides of the aisle.
Let's start there. Let's talk about what it is. I think most people have, you know, the Fed lowered the rate, they raised the rate, but they have really no idea what it is. So give us a little tutorial.
Well, the Federal Reserve is our nation's central bank. It was established a century ago. It has a very interesting structure. The federal is relevant because there's the 12 Federal Reserve districts. Here we are in the second district, but neighbors are in the first district.
And each of these districts has a certain...
Has its own president, and it's set up as a private corporation. Each bank is set up as a public-private corporation and has boards of directors. And it was designed to sort of have the whole country be part of the process rather than just having some guys in Washington. Indeed, the people in Washington, when it first started, were relatively minor in terms of the process. And it has responsibilities for the economy and for the financial system.
Well, but Ted, in terms of your description, does that mean, because there are these 12 versions of it, that each of them may be operating with a different financial outlook, or does democratic centralism, if they used to call it in the Soviet Union, does it come from the top and everybody adopts
that? Well, the monetary policy, so there's sort of two parts to the system, right? There is the monetary policy part, right, which is the interest rates part and the money supply and the exchange rates. And
that
those
comes
kinds
from
of
the top.
No, that's set by what's called the Federal Open Market Committee, and that consists of the 7 members of the Federal Reserve Board itself and the 12 presidents of the Reserve Banks, although only 5 of those presidents vote at any one time, but they all participate in the meeting. So you have 19 men and women who meet, I guess it's now 8 times a year, and they review the economy and they decide, put it crudely, whether to raise interest rates or lower interest rates, or these days to try to continue to affect long-term interest rates as well as the short-term interest rates. And the input is, although it depends a bit on the leader, some of the leaders are more collegial and democratic, if you want to put it that way, than others. But the individuals, both on the board and the presidents of the Reserve Banks, are very much their own people and speak both privately, meaning in FOMC meetings, Federal Open Market Committee, and publicly on issues. And then when they sort of, like current circumstances, they sort of say, well, I'm not so sure we should be so easy so long, right? That sends messages to the market. Maybe not always the best messages, because you then muddle the overall message.
But you do see that when they say something, that the market will react. It'll either go down.
But they react not just to what the chairman says, currently Ben Bernanke says, but also to what the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York says, or what some influential governor says, or what the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City says.
So if one goes against the prevailing wisdom, that's an announced vote, right? I mean, everybody knows how they voted. And it becomes important that just one guy sort of left.
Yeah, there is a certain collegiality. So people may be uneasy about policy, but then they don't always vote against it. They express their uneasiness, but then go along with the consensus. Again, it depends a lot on the personality of the person. At one point, it was sort of a tradition that we were raising interest rates. You voted against raising interest rates, but then as the interest rates stayed high or were being raised further, you wouldn't vote against it the second time because you've already gone on the record. That's sort of broken down. You had one president of the Reserve Bank a few years ago, Tom Honig, very good man, by the way, who voted no every time. All 8 times he had an opportunity to vote, he voted no.
No on?
On the monetary policy that was being followed, 2008, I think it was.
I wonder, Ted, if you would be kind enough to give us an opinion as to whether or not the personalities of the people on the top count, whether they're important in terms of the way in which policy is enacted.
Certainly that's the case.
And maybe you could give us a little profile.
Well, so I'll go through them historically. Okay. So Arthur Burns was a very famous economist.
He's Eisenhower time.
Right. And got appointed ultimately by Nixon to be chairman in 1970. And he was a very good economist, and he knew a lot about business cycles. And he took over from William McChesney Martin, who had been chairman for 19 years. So he sort of shook the place up in many respects.
How did he?
Well, things after 19 years, if I may put it that way, things get sort of in a rut.
Yeah.
So both in terms of the quality of thinking and so forth and so on, and so he changed the procedures and so forth and so on. He's a very strong-minded man, and he told the committee what he wanted, and basically he ran the committee, and he kept them there until they agreed with him. Then you had, for a very brief period, Bill Miller, and then you had a lot of inflation in the 1970s. Bill Miller came in under President Carter.
Where was he from?
He was an industrialist. He's a lawyer industrialist. He worked for Textron, I think was the company's name. He had been on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, so he knew something about the Federal Reserve, but he was not an economist, and he was a pretty strange appointment in some many respects. And he was much more open, so much so that the first time he chaired an FOMC meeting, FOMC, Federal Open Market Committee,
okay.
So first time he chaired one of these meetings, where normally what would happen is you'd go around and in terms of the policy debate, and everybody would say what they want the policy to be, and then the chairman would speak and say, well, I think it should be X, and they would go around again and see where they agreed with the chairman. So he went around the first time, and then he added up the comments and divided by 12. And people said, well, where's the guidance coming from the chair?
Yeah. They either resented or they loved
it. Well, that's right. So he adjusted a bit, but he was much more open in his processes. And then you had Paul Volcker, who was a very...
Wait a second. I want to back up a bit, Ted, and ask you this. These guys, they get appointed. How often is the reappointment process?
It's somewhat complicated. So the chairman of the board is both a governor and the chairman at the same time. So he has appointment as a governor.
Sure.
And additionally appointed as the chairman. And the members' terms of governors are 14 years or some component of that, because they're set periods of time. So you could be appointed to an unexpired term.
Right.
You have 7 more years, and then it expires, and then you up again. And then as chairman, you're appointed for 4 years. So you have to go through the process with the Congress, the president, and then the Congress, the Senate, confirming you every 4 years.
So go back to the ones you've told us about. I mean, what were their terms like?
So Burns went from 1970 to 1978. He had 2 terms. He wanted to have a 3rd term, but instead President Carter appointed Bill Miller.
Uh-huh.
And he was there only about 15 months, because then in the summer of 1979, and Carter was going through lots of problems in that administration
inflation.
At that time, including inflation, but there were all kinds of other issues at that issue time. He accepted the resignation of Secretary Blumenthal from the Treasury and moved Mr. Miller to the Treasury Department, and after a slight delay, he appointed Paul Volcker as chairman in the summer of 1979, who was at that point the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
So he went from the
from 1979
class A to the major.
That's right. He went from AAA. AAA, I would say. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is the most important
it's
of the
place.
Reserve banks, and had been participating in the FOMC Federal Open Market Committee meetings as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York starting in 1975, I think. So.
And he's a brilliant man, right?
He's a brilliant man, but the style, interesting question about style. So he's credited with many things, but one thing was stamping out inflation at great cost. On the other hand, inflation itself was at great cost.
Sure.
And
how'd he do it?
He said we needed to get serious about it, and he and his lieutenants, I was not one of them in this aspect, designed an approach that essentially focused on, put it simply, on the money supply and said, let the interest rates be whatever it is that that goes along with the money supply. So interest rates ended up going up to, the short-term interest rate went going up to 20%, and unemployment went up to over 10%, and we had 2 large recessions. But the way he did it, it's interesting to go back and read. He basically came in and said to the committee, I'm not sure this will work, but we have to try something, and I think this is a good idea. So he didn't pound the table and say, this is what we're going to do. He sold them on an experiment. I think he probably was more convinced it would work than the let it, but his style was one of saying to bring everybody into the tent, pushing interest rates up to 20%, which I think no one anticipated. Everybody knew would be very hard on the economy.
He's still one of the most important.
Oh, and he at 85 years old, he is
still a presence.
He is a president. I mean, he's one of the reasons why I keep working. I said, if he can work at 85, I have to keep working at 72.
I agree with you.
But he's very, very influential and strong, and has strong views on financial regulation, as we all know. As well. Then if you want me to continue.
I want to just stop and tell you a story which probably doesn't belong here. But at the point, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, I was interviewing Moynihan, and he said to come down to Washington, and I did. And he says, listen, I got to go over to the Senate because Volcker's coming up for reappointment. And you know, Moynihan could talk a lot. He knew a lot. So I went over with him. And the chair of the committee, whoever it was, came over and said, now listen, Pat, I heard the whole thing. Said, now listen, Pat, keep it short. Which is the worst thing he could have done. And Moynihan was so ticked off that he started with the American Revolution, and an hour later he was still sitting there, you know, talking about Volcker. I mean, it seemed like an hour anyway, bringing up to the present. But how many terms did Volcker actually get?
So Volcker had, just to say, Pat Moynihan, he's the one, when I went up for my confirmation hearings with 5 or 6 other people, he was the only person who asked me a question.
Right.
I think there was a sort of unwritten rule that you have 6 people there there. You have to ask each one a question as part of the confirmation. Otherwise, they haven't participated in the process.
Yeah.
So Volcker was there for 2 terms from 1979 to 1987.
Seemed like more. I know you're right.
It was a long period. And there were other things going on, like the dollar became very strong and it got weak. We had a Latin American debt crisis. We had a weakness in the financial system at that time, especially the SNL system. So there was a lot going on at that time, Reaganomics and so forth. So we were there for two terms and chose not to be reappointed.
Why do you think?
Well, the story goes basically that he was told that he could be reappointed. And I think this is basically true from my conversations with him. He's a pretty private man, but you can have conversations with him. He said, we can reappoint you, but we will not consult you about who else is going to be appointed to the board. So you're going to find yourself increasingly isolated in terms of the board. And but if you want to be reappointed, we will not take the heat of
not
reappointing you. And then he decided that enough was enough.
A sort of a backhand smash.
And he appointed Alan Greenspan, who then stayed for 18 years, essentially. So it was 1987 through 2006.
You can see my math problems, but how many terms was that?
His term ran out as governor. So it was reappointed four times. Reappointed four times, I guess it was reported five times. And but his term as governor ran out, and so you can only serve one full 14-year term. So he had a piece of the end of the Volcker term as governor.
Interesting.
So he got reappointed to that, right? And then he got reappointed as chairman all these times, and then his term as governor ran out.
And what happens when you're not governor, you can't be chairman,
right?
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so he was 2006 because the current chairman, Ben Bernanke, then took over in 2006, and his second term will run out next January.
Okay, before we get into that, which I find fascinating, we're talking to Edwin Truman, has been a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics since 2001, had a huge job at the Fed, and we're getting a terrific history. I'm so enjoying this, of what would happen. But now Greenspan was almost comedic in a way, in that, you know, he was double-speak and triple-speak, and nobody could ever understand what the hell he was talking about. He did that on purpose, didn't he?
Well, I don't know what he did. It was part of his mindset. Although he was very logical in his thinking, he tended to...
He was sort of like Casey Stengel.
He tended to sort of start here and follow a progression of thoughts, right?
But ultimately
come around back to where he started from. And if you could follow all the steps in between, you could figure out what he was saying.
But I always had the feeling, Ted, that he didn't really want you to know what he was talking about.
He famously said, if I was clear about what I said, then I made a mistake.
Funny.
And he did know what he thought, but sometimes he didn't know what he thought, so he wanted to incorporate all the uncertainties of his thinking into his answer. So rather than saying yes or no or up or down, he would say, you know, if the moon is blue or the moon is yellow or something like that, then maybe up or down.
Ever have to worry about their financial security after they leave these jobs, or do they get big jobs?
Well, of course, that's a big issue for any public servant these days. And while Volcker, for example, was until late, so the chairman of the Federal Reserve is paid the same level as a cabinet secretary, which, if I remember correctly, is sort of like $250,000 a year, which is big bucks for any normal human being.
For the rest of us, but peanuts.
But generally not so good for someone who is as smart as we hope the chairman of the Federal Reserve will be. And before it was lower. I mean, it was a level below that. Under Martin, actually, the president, may have been Johnson, demoted him, right? Got him knocked down, or Congress wanted to knock him down, so they knocked him down. So you got one step below the cabinet secretary. So you were, in the current parlance, you're probably getting $200,000 a year rather than $250,000.
But then.
And then afterwards, the chairman, I mean, they all do pretty well. I mean, Burns went to a think tank in Washington, then became ambassador to Germany. G. William Miller, after he was treasury secretary, went into essentially business on his own. Volcker went essentially into the financial sector. He ended up working for Wolfenson, but became a sort of an economic advisor type of person.
You still hear him?
Oh, yes. And that's where he made his money, because he had been a public servant most of his life.
Yeah.
He had a brief period in which he was in banking, but basically he worked in the public sector up until 1987, and he subsequently has done very well. Not that he was poor again, by the way. President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, it's at least twice as much as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So he actually took a 50% cut in salary when he became chairman of the Federal Reserve Board.
Wait a second. I'm not sure I understand that. So in other words, when you are the president of your basically local geographic thing, you make twice as much as the chairman does?
At least.
So like $500,000?
At least.
Wow. That's so interesting.
Because they have to, the theory is they have to compete with their, so those are jobs as bankers. So
sure.
They have to have a salary that at least comes in some ballpark sense, competes with the local bankers.
Because otherwise they won't respect you.
Well, or otherwise you can't get good people to take the job. Well, some combination of those two ideas.
But you still take the big job because...
Yeah, because the president asks you. But it's difficult to take the big job if you're not independently wealthy these days. I mean, one of the issues that Paul Volcker, for example, has worked on is the unattractiveness of public service, whether you're at the federal level or the state and local level, and that the country has been running against career public servants, if I may put it that way, for maybe forever, but certainly since 1980.
I don't know if you remember the name or ever knew it of Ruth Weintraub. She was my mother's closest friend and therefore Aunt Ruth. And she used to say to me all the time, you must do a tour in the federal government or in the state government because that way you become much more attractive. on the outside.
Well, that's certainly true, but that, I think, is a more difficult issue, the sort of revolving door, right?
Yeah.
So you, on the one hand, people who come in for a couple of years and then go out, right, they do get an advantage because they learn about how the place works and they trade on their experience. And that's that kind of revolving door, whatever the area or field, is sometimes appropriately problematic in terms of people sort of, is it because he's smart or is it because he happened to have some position in Washington for 2 years? And moreover, if they come in and out in 2 years, then you lose a lot of
continuity.
Yeah. So career civil servants, whatever level of government, are, in my view, as long as they understand that their job is as a civil servant rather than something else, it's underappreciated and under rewarded. And there is a tendency, I'm not sure you would probably know more about the state and local government than I do, there has been a tendency to bring in people, political appointments between the level of the Senate-confirmed political appointments,
right?
So advisors of various types, Schedule C, they're called in Washington.
Yeah.
And the problem is they sort of populate the outer offices of the Secretary of the Treasury, for example, right? And that means that the access of the career civil servants to the Secretary of the Treasury is reduced because whenever you have a meeting, right, these people want to come into the meeting. So you're lucky if you're some junior staff member, that your exposure to the Secretary of the Treasury or even the Undersecretary of the Treasury is reduced since you're already underpaid, right? Your non-monetary compensation goes down. And this is one of the issues that Volcker has worried a lot about.
When you say non-monetary compensation, you mean?
Yeah, the fact that you can work on important issues You can have conversations with the Secretary of the Treasury, the Undersecretary of the Treasury. You can feel that you're about China or European debt crisis, and you can feel that you're contributing rather than just sitting in your office and writing memos that you don't know whether they're ever going to be read. So it's a way of you get compensation, we economists would call it, compensation for the fact, kicks, if you might want to call it, kicks out of working with the Secretary or with the Chairman of the Federal Reserve on important issues.
Ted Truman, I meant to ask you, because I stopped you before you got to Bernanke, I want to get into that. You described everybody up to Bernanke. Now tell me about Bernanke.
Well, I didn't work with Bernanke, so I have my perspective is a little more distant. There is a problem, I think, as I said earlier, with respect to William McChesney Martin, who was a brilliant man and a great leader of the Federal Reserve and essentially established the Federal Reserve as we know it today, as a responsible, independent part of our government. Fascinating man in his own right. But he was there for 19 years, and I said Burns came in and sort of said, well, this has gotten a little stodgy around here, so shook things up. The same problem, I think, exists with Alan Greenspan. I mean, he was a very responsible man, a very nice man. But after 18 years, there's a certain tendency to sort of say, yes, sir, yes, sir. And the place gets a bit atrophied.
Did you have personal contact with him?
Oh, yes, both while I was there and since then. I mean, I was in and out of his office every day.
Well, that's the poop we want to hear. What was that like?
Well, that's, I think, one of the points is that so when he first came, the tradition of the senior staff was that when you thought an issue was important, you went to the chairman or the board member, if that was his or her responsibility, and said, this is going on, we need to worry about
this.
And
what was your job then?
I was head of the International Finance Division. So I worried about U.S. trade deficit and exchange rates and Mexican debt crisis and things like that. But I would go into the chairman's office and say, this is what I'm worried about. This is what we should worry about. And he would say yes or no. But he also would say, occasionally I would go and say, you were talking to this outside group and you said this. Mm. And I don't think that was right. And this happened early on when he was there. And he said, thank you. I mean, I say some things. I may have my facts wrong. I may have my analysis wrong. Part of your job is to correct me, not in public, obviously, but to correct me. By the time he left, my successors tended not to go into his, I know, my successors tended not to go into his office and say, you know, I don't think you're quite right.
Mm.
And he became somewhat distant as well from his colleagues. So Ben Bernanke, partly because he was an academic, pure academic to begin with.
We should just remember everybody that he's
now Princeton. Current chairman, and he had been on the board, so he served.
Yeah, but we should remember his Princeton background.
Yeah, he was
a esteemed academic.
Professor at Princeton, came to the board as a governor, then moved for about a year and a half to being head of the Council of Economic Advisors, and then came back as chairman of the board. Little fishy, I thought at the time, but it was fine. But he knew what he was getting into. That's the point. Like Volcker, when he came after Miller, he had been part of the process. And
what was it fishy
he changed
for Bernanke? What was it fishy for Bernanke to?
Well, I thought it was sort of a. I mean, this is slightly. So the president sort of says, "I now appoint you to the board. Now I bring you over here to the White House to be my chief economic advisor, and then I'm going to send you back to the board." And does that? In a political context, if you want to put it that way.
And that president was
George Bush,
the second.
In 2006. And so it was into his second term, so he wasn't that way. But in some sense, he was, you could say, was the chairman too close to the administration?
Yeah, too political for that job.
Yeah, too political for that job. Now, interestingly, Arthur Burns had the same position. He spent a whole year in the White House before he became chairman. Indeed, the story goes that William McChesney Martin was told Nixon told him he wanted him to step aside early, and Martin said no. So he brought Burns in as the heir apparent, had him sitting in the White House advising him for a year, then finally sent him over to the. So Bernanke came to the board, and he runs a much more, he relaxed the place, a much more collegial, less in terms of.
More like a department.
Not that he doesn't have his own ideas, obviously, and shares them, but it's a more collegial type of structure that he runs today and encourages or allows much more open discussion. Greenspan had it. He was great at discussing, by the way, and he won most of his arguments.
Greenspan.
Greenspan won most of his arguments, maybe partly for the reasons that you just described, that he could confuse his opponents. But he won most of his arguments, but he preferred to have an argument with, at most, two people, right? Because he sort of can control the conversation better than if he was talking to 12 or 15 people, and you don't know who's going to say what and how it was going to, you know. So he was a bit of a control freak in that regard.
So let me ask you a question.
But Bernanke, I think, is much more collegial in suggesting views.
So Bernanke, and the rate is at zero right now, I've never quite understood that. Maybe you can explain to me how come on my mortgage I pay 4 or 5% and the banks are getting zero.
The banks are paying you zero, you mean?
I have to pay the bank 5%.
Yeah, but the bank can get
the money for free.
Precisely.
Can you explain that to me?
Well, if the banks had to pay 3% for your money, then your mortgage would be 8%.
I see.
So it's the markup, right? The markup over the money, if you want to put it that way, and also the question of your credit risk, if I may put it that way. So the markup is related to both the sort of, if you were AAA, maybe you'd only have to have a markup of 3 percentage points. And if you're BBB, you have a markup of 7 percentage points.
Well, maybe the bank should be doing better, just takes advantage of some people, do you think?
yes. That's
My wife always quotes Andy Warhol when asked about art. He says, art is whatever you can get away with. I think that may apply in banking also.
Well, there is some competition, and that's one of the big issues, is there's maybe less competition than there should be, and sometimes if you even put it that way, the competition gets out of hand. You could argue that the financial crisis we've just been through was to some extent caused by everybody sort of competing about how they can make a fast buck, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
And investing in areas where they were was unwise to invest, including some people's mortgages.
Well, does the Fed have anything to do with that?
Yes, that's the whole regulatory side of the Federal Reserve, which is much more complicated because in the Federal Reserve's role in the regulatory system, financial regulatory system, is to a substantial extent shared. It has an overall responsibility, and that's one of the reasons why it was set up, to maintain financial stability, whatever that
So did
means.
They fail in this case?
The answer Everybody
has,
failed.
The answer has to be yes, right?
Everybody failed.
Okay.
They were part of the failure.
Should they have known what was going on with these, you know, mortgages and the...
Yes, they certainly should have known. They knew some of it, and that was one of the issues with respect to Chairman Greenspan. One of the members of the board was uncomfortable with some of the developments in the mortgage market and went to the chairman and said, maybe we should do something about this, and he basically said no. In some sense, in the crisis, that was one sin of commission, if you want to put it that way. A lot of the problems in the global financial crisis were sins of omission, in the sense that they, the way you asked the question, they should have known, and then they should have had the guts to say, this is going too far.
Well, except that these are the brightest people, like economists in the world. Why didn't they know?
Well, they did. To some extent. So it's now a matter of public record that in 2005 and 2006, which is when the housing bubble was going on,
sure,
they had a lot of discussions of that, and they had discussions of a special presentation of what will happen if there's a collapse, right? And the economists put together a presentation for the Federal Open Market Committee, I understand. I mean, I think it's now a matter of public record, or will soon be. And they said, well, let's assume that there is a collapse of the price of housing across the country, which had not happened in the United States since the 1930s. So we had a lot of collapse of housing markets, New England, Texas, California, but it tended not to be nationwide. So they said, let's assume that we have a collapse of the housing market. And what are the implications going to be for the economy of that collapse of the housing market? And they ran that through their models, and the answer was not good, but not disaster. And so in a way, they had not understood how the housing market and its financing was associated with other aspects of the financial system, both here and abroad. And you had this cascading effect. It's now used, they use a fancy term, which actually Ben Bernanke studied and wrote about, of the amplification effect. So you have this small...
He did his work on the Depression.
On the Depression. So you have a small financial problem, and it gets amplified in terms of its effect on the real economy. And they hadn't taken into account that amplification effect. Or to the extent that they did, they said it's going to be a factor of 2 when it was a factor of 10. So they were looking... But they didn't.
Do
I think see the right thing. And it's fair to say they didn't act. One of the complaints, just is both on the supervisory side, and on the monetary policy, they probably should have been running a tighter monetary policy than they did, including trying to influence mortgage rates.
I want to ask a question, and I've heard it mumbled here and there. I don't know if it's true or not. I wanted to ask you. Our present governor, Andrew Cuomo, mm-hmm. was at HUD, mm-hmm. and we are told that he was very anxious to get everybody as part of his philosophy. He was a more liberal fellow then than we see now. He wanted to get everybody into a house. So he said to, you know, the various groups that gave out the money and the rest of it, get everybody into a house, and that may have, in fact, caused some of the problem. Were you close enough to see it?
Yes, yes and no. I mean, close enough in the sense that we worried about these kinds of things. That is a nonpartisan attitude. I mean, we Americans believe that your home is your castle, right? And everybody deserves a castle. But there was concern about the structure, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, ended up collapsing. So, on a bipartisan basis, you had both Larry Summers as the Secretary of the Treasury and Alan Greenspan, Republican, as the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, worrying that these institutions, Fannie and Freddie, were undercapitalized and were making money on the implicit guarantee of the taxpayers. That was a big issue, but it was very difficult to get the Congress to address that issue.
Because they didn't
because that
they didn't
was kind
of get in the way of getting people into
their houses. And so you have your now Governor Cuomo at HUD and in the Clinton administration, and then you had in 2004, I remember this vividly, as President Bush announced his campaign. He said one of the things we've accomplished is we've added home ownership has gone up by 3%. I think it was 3 percentage points under my administration.
Sure.
And this is what we're all about, right? We're delivering to the American people. So it was. So the notion of getting people in the home, into homes, without worrying about whether they can pay the mortgages, and the terms of those mortgages was certainly was part of the problem.
I wanted to, because you are an expert in this, I wanted to ask you about China. Mm-hmm. China, of course, has been fooling with the exchange rate one way or the other. Can you explain to us what's going on there?
So China, in 1994, it adopted an exchange rate pegged to the dollar. And that peg to the dollar was maintained, a certain number of yuan to the dollar, 5.6 or something like that, maybe it's more than that, 6.5, I think, or something like that. And it was maintained for a long period of time. The problem was that as the Chinese economy became more productive, and in particular in the first early days of this century, that meant that at that fixed exchange rate, it was able to export a lot more and import a lot relative to its imports and build up a large trade surplus with us, but more importantly, in many respects, in all respects, with the world as a whole.
So has that rate, though, I got to get this right.
Because
though,
so normally you would say, yeah. Well, as a country starts exporting more and more relative to its imports, you say, well, that's going to mean you're going to have a surplus, and you're essentially, if there's unemployment in the world as a whole, that you're exporting unemployment to the rest of the world. And so what you should do is allow the market to push your exchange rate up, right? So that we, so that rather than 6.5 yuan to the dollar, it goes down to 5 yuan to the dollar, right?
So what would make them do that if they're experiencing success the way they were?
Well, that precisely. So they didn't do it.
Right.
And their surplus, their overall surplus, reached 10% of GDP, current account surplus, as we economists call it. Starting in the early part of the Bush administration, 2003, 2004, we increased the pressure on them to move their rate, which ultimately in 2005 they did. Gradually, so they had a small adjustment, but they kept it. They control selling. They control if someone wants yuan, they give them. They hold the dollars, right? They intervene. They collect the dollars. Think about it in the simplest of terms. So they're exporting, right? That gets them brings in dollars, right? So they essentially buy those dollars and they stick them in their bank, or they stick them in their bank, who then reinvests them abroad, so they don't, including in the United States. So they have $3 trillion plus, more than $3 trillion worth of reserves, foreign exchange reserves, right now, of which maybe 70% are held in U.S. dollars. So $2 trillion of U.S. assets, U.S. dollar assets.
Is this a sovereign, approach? In other words, the countries who have sovereign accounts.
Well, they actually use their reserves to create what I've written about called sovereign wealth funds. A sovereign wealth fund is a small component of their, But if you have, it's just like you, maybe, right? So they have to worry. If they're going to build up $3 trillion worth of reserves, they have to invest them somehow, right? They
sure.
could buy, they could hold them in dollar bills. That doesn't turn, they want a return. So they have to figure out how safely to deploy those reserves, and if you're that big a player in the global financial markets, $3 trillion is not chicken feed. You can be concerned, right? And people are concerned. For example, well, what if they dump all those dollars someday?
What would happen to us with the bottom fallout here?
Yeah, right. Now,
in other words, let me say that one more time. If what they've invested in the United States, if they pull their money, what would happen in the United States?
Well, the price what they sold would the price of what they sold would go down, right? So they say they invested in treasury bonds or the stock market, right? And they all of a sudden dumped all their holdings of U.S. Equities or U.S. treasury bonds. The price of those things would go down, right? Now that's the reason why they won't do it. Because if they dumped the first $100 billion, right, after they dumped the first $100 billion, people would figure out that they were driving down the value of their last $2 trillion.
But from a political point of view, if you think about it, it's probably pretty good because we're unlikely on either side to go to war with somebody. I remember interviewing a congressman and he's saying, "Why do we need another couple of $1 billion submarine?" And he said, "The Chinese." I said, "Please, give me a break." I mean, the Chinese still can be aggressive and all the rest of it, but they know which side their bread is buttered on, right?
Yes, but you have to. I think we have to understand that and you would understand, that although China's political system is different than ours, it is still a political system. So it's not as if the new president Xi controls everything. He has a bunch of other people, right, in the central bank, in the army, in the commerce department, their equivalent of the commerce department, and they all have their own.
He has his own constituency. They all have
multiple constituencies, yeah. And the risk is that not everybody sees it as clearly as you just explained. You know, we have a certain mutual assured destruction process, as we did with the Soviet Union.
Sure.
But the same applies in broad sense in the economic world. We could blow up the system. They could blow up the system. It's not in our interest. Neither of our interests to do that as long as someone doesn't do something stupid.
So how pervasive is their power in the United States? I'm thinking of this case we're seeing now. NYU takes one of the dissidents, gives them housing, gives them a job. The Chinese say, "We don't like this," and they get rid of the professor. You know, is this proof positive that they have a lot of power? Because the NYU wants to set up a university in China, nothing doing if you keep this guy on your faculty.
Well, yes. So I think the answer is to your simple answer to your question is yes, they have some considerable influence now. Presumably, the NYU has had some problems recently, at least domestic. You know, when they chose to give this guy asylum, one would think, thought about how that would affect NYU's relationship with China. And if they didn't think about that, then the people who made the decision weren't doing their job.
Yeah. So often I say, you know, when you're hiring somebody, you have to think about the potential for firing them also.
And you need to, you know, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but if you end up too conservative, then NYU also gained some notoriety, right? So there was a plus for NYU as well as the minus for NYU.
And you mean it was a plus when they took the guy in.
Right, so.
But it's not a plus now.
That's right.
Listen, all I can say is we're out of time. Our guest has been Edwin Truman, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Ted, thanks so much for joining us. And let me just say, I believe this should be the first conversation we had because we have a long way to go and a lot of other things I want to talk to you about. Is that okay to you?
It's all right with me. That's my pleasure.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.